Our text this evening comes from Psalm 46. Psalm 46, the title reads, "To the music director belonging to the sons of Korah, upon Alamoth, a song. God is our refuge and strength, a well-proved help in troubles. Therefore, we're not going to fear when the earth changes, when the mountains topple into the heart of the seas. Let its waters roar, let them foam, let the mountains tremble in its raging. A river, its streams make glad the city of God, the holy dwelling of the Most High. God is in the midst of her. She will not topple. God will help her when morning breaks. Nations have roared, kingdoms have toppled. He has thundered with his voice. The earth melts. Yahweh of hosts is with us. The God of Jacob is our high fortress. Come, look at the works of Yahweh, the desolations he has made in the earth, causing wars to stop to the end of the earth. He shatters the bow. He snaps the spear. He burns the battle wagons in the fire. Stop it. And know that I am God. I will be exalted among the nations. I will be exalted throughout the earth. Yahweh of hosts is with us. The God of Jacob is our high fortress." There was a man in Wales in the 1930s or so who had a position as a pilot down at the docks. It was a fairly good position, but he was kind of a hopeless drunkard in a way, and he had, though, at a certain time later, three photographs that were on his mantelpiece. One of them was a photograph of him leaning helplessly against a lamppost taken by one of his former friends. He was drunk, and the one-word caption for that was "lost." And then there was another photograph. It showed him beside his pastor, Martin Lloyd-Jones, down at the beach with a group of men one Monday when they had time off, where he was first engaged in spiritual conversation. And the one-word caption for that picture was "found." And then there was a third photograph. It showed him neatly clad and spruced up, his life centered in the gospel, and the caption to that photograph was "saved." Lost, found, saved. Three photographs that summed up, as it were, the trend of his life. And Psalm 46, the sons of Korah in Psalm 46, present us with three pictures in this psalm. The keynote of the psalm, obviously, is that confession of faith at the beginning. God is our refuge and strength. And, of course, the sons of Korah want you to say, as a result of this psalm, "And God is still our refuge and strength." But they give us these three pictures. God is our refuge and strength in what may be, verses 1 to 3, in what always is, verses 4 to 7, and in what will be, verses 8 to 11. I want to track the pictures through the psalm. The first picture I want you to look at, then, is God's people amid the chaos, verses 1 to 3. God's people amid the chaos. Now, it begins with this confession of faith, as I said, in the first part of verse 1. God is our refuge and strength. And then a well-proved help in troubles. That's part of the confession of faith, too. But in a way, I think that phrase, "a well-proved help in troubles," is sort of the basis of the confession. It's why we know God is our refuge and strength, because we've already found him by experience to be a well-proved help in troubles. So that's a sort of a support to this confession of faith. But at any rate, there's a confidence and a conviction here. And because of this confidence and conviction that we confess, we go on to say, therefore, verse 2, we're not going to fear for what we have not yet faced, whatever it may be. We're not going to fear. We've never yet faced chaos. But on the basis of God's help to date, we do not fear even what we have not yet experienced and what is yet beyond us and unknown. Well, that's the logic of it. It's the same sort of thing as you have in 1 Samuel 17 and verse 37. You may remember when King Saul was interviewing David, and David had offered to go fight the Philistine giant Goliath. And Saul was trying to tell David, you know, you're just a youth. Yeah, it means you're inexperienced, but he's been a man of war from his youth. And I don't know how that interview went in detail and so on. You might imagine that David said, Saul, O king, have you ever been a shepherd? Have you ever realized that sometimes you could die a dozen times in a month because you have to face marauding beasts coming after your flock and so on? Have you ever had to disembowel a lion? Well, maybe he didn't say that to Saul, I don't know. But have you ever stared a lion or a bear eyeball to eyeball and have to defend your flock from them and so on? And then David went on to say, Yahweh, who delivered me from the paw of the lion and from the paw of the bear, will deliver me from the hand of this Philistine. On the basis of what he has done already in delivering me in these circumstances, he will also deliver me in this one. Though it may be scary and though I may not know what all is involved and so on the basis of what he has done, he will do the same for what I have not yet faced. Because what you need to know is not how severe the assault may be, but how adequate your resources are. God is our refuge and strength, a well-proved help in troubles. Now, notice the possibility he paints here in the last of verse 2 and verse 3. We're not going to fear when the earth changes, when the mountains topple into the heart of the seas. Let its waters roar, let them foam, let the mountains tremble in its raging. Such chaos implies serious questions about God's control. When the earth changes, when the mountains topple into the heart of the seas. Or as some of your translations have, the mountains are moved into the heart of the seas. That word, that verb, I've translated it topple, or in some of your translations it's translated move. The mountains are moved into the heart of the seas. It's not supposed to happen. You know, that verb is used, well, it's used two other places in this psalm, but it's used in the other psalms. And in Psalm 93 and verse 1, it talks about the Lord reigns, and then it says, the world shall never be moved or toppled. That's that verb. It's because the Lord reigns and he's in control. There's a certain stability to the created order. It's not going to plunge to total disaster. You have the same thing, ditto, in Psalm 96, verse 10. And then in Psalm 104 and verse 5, it has a graphic picture that God has set the earth on its foundations, as if it were a house to be built, so that it should never be moved. If God's in control, then the created order should not turn to mush. There should be a certain stability. And you see what the psalm here in Psalm 46, the possibility it's raising. We're not going to fear when the earth changes, when the mountains topple into the heart of the seas, when they're moved into the heart of the seas. That shouldn't happen if God's really in control. It seems to me that what the sons of Korah are saying is, even when everything is so crumbly and chaotic that even God doesn't appear to be in control, even then, God is our refuge and strength. It is some picture that they are painting. Now, why do the psalmists paint such an extreme picture? Unless they know that there are times when the world seems to cave in on God's people. And they want us to be able to face that. Sometimes it's physical, isn't it? in the created order. 6.6 earthquake in central Italy the last day or two. Sometimes there are physical disturbances. Charles Wesley was preaching one morning. It was March 8th, 1750 in London. And there had been an earthquake a month before. But then again, exactly a month later on March 8th, 1750, well, let me just quote from Charles Wesley. He said, "This morning, a quarter after five, we had another shock of an earthquake far more violent than that of February 8th. I was just repeating my text when it shook the foundry." Now, the foundry was the place where the Wesleyans gathered for worship and exposition of the word and so on there in London. It was a quarter after five. You think you're doing well to come out on a Sunday night at 6 o'clock? How about 5:15 on a weekday morning? Well, that's when they were gathered. Okay, a quarter after five, we had another shock. I was just repeating my text when it shook the foundry so violently we all expected it to fall on our heads. A great cry followed from the women and children. I immediately cried out, "Therefore we will not fear, though the earth be moved and the hills be carried into the midst of the sea. For the Lord of hosts is with us. The God of Jacob is our refuge. He filled my heart with faith and my mouth with words, shaking their souls as well as their bodies." Now, sometimes there can be physical upheaval. Fire, floods, etc. If not earthquakes. You people in Colombia, speaking of fire, haven't forgotten February 1865, have you? And you haven't forgotten, speaking of floods, of October 2015, have you? I mean, even then. So sometimes it can be physical disturbance. Sometimes it could be political. It could be, I'm not sure, it could be that they describe this earth-shattering turmoil as a way of describing the turmoil among nations and kingdoms and so on in the world. And that maybe this is a way, a picture and a way of describing political turmoil and upheaval. Or it could be that it's a way of describing, in a way, personal upheaval. It only takes one or two circumstances to turn to crud, doesn't it? And your whole life comes crashing down. You know what it's like. The created order might go on, but your own circumstances might be a disaster and might have fallen in on your head even then. God is our refuge and strength. Think of your greatest fear, perhaps, or anxiety. Some of us, you know, wonder, what if someday I'm sitting in a chair in the hallway staring blankly because I'm in an Alzheimer's facility? And can we say, even then, God is our refuge and our strength? So they press this upon us. Now, I want to back away here just a moment. I don't want to stay on this picture too long, but we need to follow up just a little bit. Since the focus is on God, we have to ask, what God is it who is our refuge and strength here? And so we bring in then, along with verse 1, verses 7 and 11, this refrain. So if God's our refuge and strength, what sort of God? He's the God of all resources. Do you see what verse 7 and 11 say? Yahweh of hosts is with us. It's actually Yahweh hosts. It's as if to say Yahweh, it's a kind of a military. Yahweh is the equivalent of hosts, or Yahweh is worth divisions. All the resources, all the armies of heaven, all the resources of the universe are at Yahweh's disposal. He's the Lord of legions. This is what Jesus said in Matthew 26, verse 53. Don't you know that I can appeal to my Father and He would send me at once more than 12 legions of angels? That's more than 72,000. It's quite a platoon. That's Yahweh of hosts. Your God's the God of all resources. And then He's the God of all grace. Now, in verse 7 and 11, it refers to Him as Yahweh. You go back to Exodus chapter 3 and verse 12, and you must remember that that name, that divine name Yahweh, was a sort of a shorthand that was given, that was meant to embody and condense and summarize that promise and assurance that Yahweh gave to Moses in Exodus 3:12. But I will be with you. Can you say it in one crunched down word? Yes, Yahweh. The God who is present with His people to be what He needs to be for them in their distress. He's the God of all grace because He's Yahweh, the present God. And then He's also the God of Jacob, as our high Lord, the God of Jacob. Jacob is our covenant ancestor. And so this means He's a covenant God who commits Himself to an undeserving people. Interesting, He doesn't say God of Abraham, but God of Jacob. That scheming, conniving character. He's the God of Jacob. He's the God of grace who commits Himself in covenant to an undeserving people. So He's the God of all resources, and He's the God of all grace, and He's the God of all circumstances. We could flesh this out more, but let me just cut to just that last line of verse 1. A well-proved help in troubles. Not trouble, as some translations have it. It's not some abstract kind of concept called trouble. It's a plural. Troubles. Many are the afflictions of the righteous, Psalm 34 said. Troubles, troubles, troubles. God's people have gobs of them. As 1 Peter 1:6 says, you are made sorrowful now by multicolored trials. He's a well-proved help in troubles. He's the God of all circumstances, especially difficult ones. This is our God. In verses 1 to 3, it's as if the sons of Korah have cheated and have had a sneak preview. And we're really singing Romans 8:35. Who shall separate us from the love of Christ? Shall tribulation or distress or persecution or famine or nakedness or peril or sword? God's people amid the chaos. A second picture. God's presence in the city. Verses 4 to 7. God's presence in the city. And it begins, a river! Exclamation mark. Its streams make glad the city of God, the holy dwelling of the Most High. God is in the midst of her. She will not topple. God will help her when morning breaks, etc. God's presence in the city. Now, you have to have a little literary feel of the psalm here. You notice you've just come from verses 2 and 3, where you have the boiling, crashing seas and everything seemingly coming unglued in creation. And then all of a sudden, you have a peaceful river. Just a river. Its streams make glad the city of God. A sustaining river like the Saluda when we drove over it tonight on the way into church. A very placid. I know rivers can get difficult, but the idea here is a very peaceful kind of thing. It suggests, well, it reminds me of something when we were, our children were, our sons were small, used to read to them Bible stories, and some of them were, some put out by the Missouri Synod Lutherans, and there was one about Jonah, and it had a little cassette tape with it. You remember cassette tape, some of you. Okay. This had a cassette tape with it, and so we would put it in. And Burl Ives was reading the story, and you turn the pages as you go through. And I remember in the first, talking about the first chapter of Jonah, here's Jonah, and they find that a terrible storm comes up, and he draws the shortest straw, and they're debating about trying to, whether to throw him overboard, like he says, or not. And there's all this background noise. There's wind, you know, the sound effects, and the crashing of waves and so on. And Burl Ives has to talk and read the story above all this racket so that you can hear it and so on. And then finally they get up the nerve and they throw Jonah overboard and everything's quiet. And Burl Ives goes along just reading normally because all that racket has been reduced. Well, that's the effect from verses 2 to 3 to verse 4. Now, there are some who think, you know, there's that refrain in verse 7 and 11 at the end of the other two parts of the psalm. Really, if the psalm was put together right, there should be that refrain after verse 3. Yahweh of hosts is with us, the God of Jacob is our refuge. Was that omitted? It said, no, it wasn't. It would be nice to have that refrain at three places, I suppose, but would have screwed up the psalm. The psalmist wants you to hear the crashing of verses 2 and 3, and then immediately after that, a river, its streams make glad the city of God. And if you put a verse of two lines in there, like that refrain, you'll miss it. You won't get it because it won't be right up against each other. He wants to give you, I think he wants to strike a note of a strange peace, a river. I may be wrong here, so you don't need to stone me if you don't agree with me, but you have another text, you know, that's very like verse 4, Genesis 2:10, where we read, and a river was flowing out of Eden. That's interesting. And here, a river. It streams. Is it as if the sons of Korah want you to have a kind of a flashback to paradise? To get a kind of a whiff of paradise in the midst of earth's trouble? Sometimes there is a strange peace, you know. Are they trying to conjure up your memory? It's October. And in October in western Pennsylvania, in our small town, we had maple leaves would fall. And we would rake them down to the ditch along the highway. And then, you know, didn't have burning regulations there. We weren't a bunch of arsonists or anything, but you rake the leaves down in that ditch along the highway, and you're vigilant. You have your rake there and so on. But you burnt the leaves in the ditch. Love the smell of burning maple leaves. And you know, as you go along in life, most years you never smell burning maple leaves and so on because you live in big cities, etc., larger cities. But every once in a while, you're out in the sticks somewhere and you smell burning leaves and it conjures up that memory. I think, a river, it streams. Ah! Reminds me of Genesis 2:10. There's a river flowing out of Eden. There's sometimes a strange peace in the middle of turmoil. A sort of like in, I think as Shelby Foote tells about it, probably the latter part of 1863, a war between the states. General Grant was out around Chattanooga, and he was kind of scouting out the federal lines. And he came to a spring that was used by both Confederate and federal soldiers at different times. And there was a soldier in a blue coat sitting on a log near the spring with his musket right beside him. And Grant spoke to him, I guess, the soldier stood up and respectfully saluted Grant and so on. And Grant asked him what corps he was from. And he said he was one of Longstreet's men. Oh, so he must have gotten that blue coat from a dead federal on the battlefield because he himself was a Confederate private, and here's the commanding general of the Union forces, and they meet there at the spring. But Shelby Foote says they had quite a chat. And then Grant went off. You say, but there's a war going on. Yeah, but there are all kinds of stories like that. There's a war going on, but in the midst of that war, sometimes there are the strangest episodes of peace. And sometimes God does that for you. In the midst of your world that is caved in on your head, sometimes he gives you a moment of peace. Maybe a whiff of paradise in the midst of the clamor. Now, not only a strange peace here in the city, but also the big secret that we have to pay attention to. Now, that's in verse 5. This city, I think, is Jerusalem. Zoan, I think they're thinking of Jerusalem, but they're thinking of far more than that. It's the holy dwelling place. It's the holy dwelling of the Most High. They're thinking of it as the place where God's people dwell as well. And he says, this is the big secret in verse 5, God is in the midst of her. She will not topple. Now, there's our verb topple, or be moved again. You notice that it's used here in the first part of verse 5. It was used in verse 2 about the mountains toppling into the heart of the seas. It's used in verse 6 when it speaks of kingdoms that have toppled. But there's something that will not topple, the city of God, because God is in the midst of her. She will not topple. Mountains and kingdoms may topple. God's city will not, because God's presence is there. God's presence in the city. This is Reformation Sunday. And there was a time when Philip Melanchthon, Martin Luther's deputy, you might say, his New Testament scholar and Greek scholar and so on whom he leaned quite a bit. Melanchthon was very discouraged and apparently in despair over the progress of the Protestant Reformation. And Luther said to Philip, "If we perish, Christ must fall too. He is in the midst of us." That's the big secret. But then there's more here, and we can say we should look at the right time, because that's underlined. Look at the last of verse 5. God will help her, that is, his city, his people. God will help her when morning breaks. I want you to look at that phrase, when morning breaks. Literally, at the turning of the morning. There's one other place in the Old Testament where that phrase, at the turning of the morning, is used. It's used in Exodus chapter 14 and verse 27 in the deliverance of Israel from Pharaoh. Here's Exodus 14, verse 27. So Moses stretched out his hand over the sea, and the sea returned to its normal course at the turning of the morning. And as the Egyptians fled into it, Yahweh shook off the Egyptians into the midst of the sea. Only here in Psalm 46 and in Exodus 14:27, what are they trying to say? What are the sons of Korah wanting to say when they say God will help her at the turning of the morning? He wants to conjure up in your mind that other turning of the morning and the deliverance at the sea. That's the kind of God you have. The God who is in the midst of his people to defend them. Now, there's a sort of a pattern of morning deliverances. God seems to have a thing about the morning. Some of you have highlighted or underlined in your Bibles Psalm 30, verse 5. Weeping may endure for the night, but joy comes with the morning. It's not that that's always the case. The text doesn't say that, but that's typical of the way God operates. He has a thing about the morning. There's a scholars aren't sure. I don't think they can be sure anyway, but there are some scholars who think that the background to Psalm 46 may be an episode that took place in 701 B.C. when Hezekiah was the king of Judah. And you can read about it in 2 Kings 18 and 19, for example. Sennacherib, the king of Assyria, was besieging Jerusalem. He had reduced all of Judah. He had taken captives. He had ravaged the land, and now he was wanting to reduce Jerusalem, and he was ready to put it under siege. And the prophet Isaiah had told Hezekiah that Sennacherib would not shoot an arrow there, and he would not enter the city of Jerusalem. And he didn't. 2 Kings 19:35 tells about it. On that night, the angel of Yahweh went forth and struck down 185,000 in the camp of Assyria. And when they rose early in the morning, why, they were all corpses. Doesn't mean that the corpses rose and saw that they were corpses, but rather that when people rose in the morning, they saw that all the Assyrian army were corpses. There were all sorts of surplus Assyrian sleeping bags in the army and navy surplus stores in Judah because of what God did by the terror of the night to the Assyrian army. And Sennacherib had to go back to Assyria with his tail between his legs, and he never reduced Jerusalem. Now, Sennacherib had a room in his quarters in Assyria. It was 38 feet by 18 feet. We could call it the Lachish or Lachish room. It depicted the Assyrian conquest of Lachish when they were down there in Judah in graphic detail. Lachish was a few miles west-southwest of Jerusalem, and they reduced it to rubble and so on. And so he had his Lachish room. Why didn't Sennacherib have a Jerusalem room? Oh, because Yahweh did a strange thing one night to the Assyrian army. And he never had his Jerusalem room because joy came in the morning. And what about Luke 24 and John 20 and all of that? You remember about those two disciples on the way to Emmaus, and this stranger joins them, and he doesn't seem to know much about what's happened in Jerusalem, about how Jesus, the mighty prophet in word and deed, had been crucified, etc., etc. And then they said, but we had hoped that he was the one to redeem Israel. Such sadness and despair. But then you get into John 20, for example. Early on the first day of the week, while it was still dark, Mary Magdalene came to the tomb, and God helped us at the turning of the morning. Often we find grace at just the right time. And why? Because God's presence is in the city, and He helps His people when morning breaks. Now, I'm going to press your patience so we don't take you to that third picture, God's peace throughout the world, verses 8 to 11, actually verses 8 to 10, really, God's peace throughout the world. This tells us in these verses where things are heading. And you have two segments here. You've got in verses 8 to 9, the invitation to witness, an invitation to witness. This talks about Yahweh in the third person. And then you have a command to submit in verse 10, where God Himself speaks. It's the first person. Notice the I. He says, stop it and know that I am God. I will be exalted among the nations. Okay, so that's a command to submit. So you have these two segments. You notice that in verses 8 and 9, it has a depiction of what Yahweh does or will be doing. Look at the desolations He's made in the earth, causing wars to stop to the end of the earth. He shatters the bow. He snaps the spear. He burns the battle wagons in the fire. You may want to update that for today. You know, change the bow and spear and battle wagons to stealth bombers and tanks and so on. But you get the picture. He causes wars to stop. This is a picture of forcible disarmament among the nations. And this doesn't take place or won't take place because governments make dreary pronouncements like the UN might about the insanity of war. Well, yes. Or because other governments give their diplomatic reactions, their negative diplomatic reactions to certain rogue nations when they commit atrocities. What is done? Oh, we make statements about this is absolutely unacceptable. Ooh, unacceptable. Such a strong word. But not just unacceptable, but absolutely unacceptable. Well, we say this is a cause of grave concern to our government. Not just concern, but grave concern. Oh, that's powerful. This is diplomatic soft talk. But you see, when God is ready, He will be causing wars to stop to the end of the earth. And He will impose His disarmament on the nations that seek to attack and reduce His people. So you have that there in verse 9. But we need to look more closely at verse 10. As I said, that's first person, God speaking, I, all right? So it's direct speech, and it's really a victory pronouncement. I will be exalted among the nations. I will be exalted throughout the earth. Now, who's the audience primarily for verse 10? To whom is this being spoken? And what's the tone of this statement? You may not have liked the way I translated it. You might prefer the traditional be still and know that I am God. Well, we can keep that for the time being. To whom is that being said? Well, there are some who think that's being said to Judah or to God's people. And He's saying, in all the chaos and the turmoil, be still. Don't be disturbed. And know that I'm God. I've got things under control. Okay, I'm not convinced that that's the way it's to be taken. I think probably the nations are the primary audience of this statement in verse 10. The nations that are in uproar. Notice they're in the immediate context, verse 6. Nations have roared, kingdoms have toppled. And then in verses 8 and 9, it's the wars and the battlements, about weaponry, etc., of the nations that God is reducing to nothing. And so when you get to verse 10, I think He's speaking to the nations who are hostile to Him and to His people. I think that's the better choice here. And I think if it was the people of Judah, for instance, that He was speaking to, He would have said, be still and know that I am Yahweh. The covenant name of God, particularly appropriate to His people. But He said, be still and know that I am God, which would be the generic term for deity, which is more likely to fit with the nations and those outside the covenant circle, etc. So I think what you have here is an address to the nations and so on. Now, We usually, there are two ways, you know, let's come back to this thing. Because it's been so traditionally translated, be still and know that I am God. There are two ways of saying be still, you know. And the way it's usually taken and the way we tend to jump to application here is be still and know that I am God. And what do you have? He conjures up a picture of a devotional booklet. Of a scene in New Hampshire where you have a red barn and a white farmhouse and 8 inches of fresh driven, pure snow on the ground. And across the front of that booklet is written, be still and know that I am God. Psalm 46, 10a. As if saying to you, get your study Bible and your devotional book and come here in front of the fireplace and have your quiet time. Get alone with the Lord. Now, there are texts that teach that, all right? Okay? I don't think this is one of them. I think that's the way we've tended to run with it. But there's another way of saying be still. And you know what it's like. You have 3 or 4 kids, etc. You're around the kitchen table and you're trying to eat a reasonable supper meal and so on. And somehow unusually. For a covenant family, there's bickering and nitpicking and somehow it just, and it finally it just gets to you. It reaches a kind of crescendo and you say, be still! Which means, stop it. Well, that's the way the verb is here. It means stop it. Leave off. You could translate it. Yahweh is speaking to the hostile nations of the world who seek to crush his people, and he says, stop it and know that I am God. Now, you may not agree with that, but I should say that that was, by the way, Calvin's view, so it must be right, whatever you may think. Verse 10 is very close to its New Testament version, Philippians 2, 9 to 11. If you say, what does that say? Oh, you should know that. That should be a text you've committed to memory. Philippians 2, 9 to 11. Look it up if you have to. But verse 10 is very close to that. I will be exalted among the nations. I will be exalted throughout the earth. That's the basic statement of last things that you need in order to survive. It really summarizes the first half of the Lord's Prayer, doesn't it? The time's going to come when Yahweh's name, according to Ezekiel 36, is going to be hallowed among the nations and no longer be profane. When his kingdom will come, what's that mean? Next clause, when his will be done on earth as it is in heaven. I will be exalted among the nations. I will be exalted throughout the earth. There it is. And yet this text, verse 10, the last part of it especially, which is my comfort, is also my critic. Because when I look at those last two lines of verse 10, even though I claim membership in the city of God, even though I claim a place among the Lord's people, etc., my idolatry is such that I am more concerned with being comfortable in my own little realm of life than with that God's kingship be visible throughout the world. And so that statement in verse 10, those last two lines, though they anchor, those words anchor me and secure me, they also expose me and they call me to dust and ashes repentance, where my self-absorbed navel gazing on my life rather than on God's interests. But this tells you, doesn't it, where things are headed. There's a little basic primer for last things. I will be exalted among the nations. I will be exalted throughout the earth. I know where things are heading. I know how they will turn out. That anchors you tremendously. You remember perhaps seeing or hearing of that Peanuts cartoon. The rain is just pouring down in all four frames of the cartoon. And Lucy and Linus are looking out the window, and Lucy says, boy, look at it rain. What if it floods the whole world? And Linus says, it will never do that. In the 9th chapter of Genesis, God promised Noah that would never happen again, and the sign of the promise is the rainbow. Lucy says, you've taken a great load off my mind. And Linus says, sound theology has a way of doing that. Now, this is sound theology. I will be exalted among the nations. I will be exalted throughout the earth. Nothing's going to stop that. That's going to be God's peace throughout the world. So, this psalm is the word for you. You who hang on to Yahweh, though you're a fragile piece of humanity, seeming to be at the mercy of shaking mountains and crashing earth and the political purgatory of nations, so that you can say, God is still our refuge and strength. We are not going to fear. Let us pray. Our God and Savior, you are our refuge in each deep distress. You, our strength and glorious righteousness. Through flames and floods, you lead us safely on, and daily make your sovereign goodness known. No wonder once again we come to give thanks to you for the God you are. Amen.